Señoras y señores, vamos a empezar con su permiso. Me llamo René Provost, yo soy profesor de Derecho acá en la Facultad de Derecho y también en el Centro de Derechos Humanos y Pluralismo Jurídico. It's my pleasure to welcome you here at McGill for those of you who are from beyond the university's wall, and it's my pleasure to welcome students from both the law faculty and the rest of the university. The event tonight is organized by the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, as well as the Crépeau Center for Private and Comparative Law, both housed here in the faculty. And before going further, I do want to salute two people who are linked to neither centers, Mariela Tovar and Claudia Flament, who are the driving forces behind this event. So thank you to both of them. So there is a presence in the room tonight of someone who is not there, Leopoldo Lopez, who has been imprisoned for a year now in Venezuela and still awaiting possibly a trial to legalize his status at the moment. And we will hear more about it in just a few moments from our two speakers. Now, as you probably know, Venezuela has known a period of greater and greater instability over the last decade or so, with an increased turn to the unjustified use of force by both state and non-state actors, paramilitary groups, leading to imprisonment of many people and mistreatment, sometimes going as far as acts that of torture at the hands of prison officials. This has been accompanied by, I think, what could be fairly described as the gutting of the Venezuelan judiciary for the last decade, a sort of political takeover of the court and the replacement of independent judges by judges without tenure and who can be removed at the will of the executive, and indeed judges have been imprisoned for issuing decisions that displeased the executive in Venezuela. This has been combined with repression of freedom of the press, of the media, with new laws being adopted to permit the revocation of the licenses of various media outlets in the country, which were indeed revoked, leading to a silencing of any opposition voices in the country. And finally, this has led to the persecution of people working in human rights NGOs and in civil society, as well as human rights defenders and anyone linked to the opposition in Venezuela. The treatment of Leopoldo López in particular has been characterized as a violation of fundamental human rights by the UN Human Rights, by the UN Working Group on Enforced and Involuntary Disappearances, as well as by the Inter-American Commission and Court of Human Rights. And a year and a half ago, Venezuela went ahead and formally denounced the American Convention on Human Rights, becoming only the second state ever to turn its back on the inter-American human rights system in the Americas. And this connects these events to this place here because of the very significant potential for regional destabilization flowing from the events in Venezuela when he announced the country's decision to withdraw from the Inter-American system. Hugo Chavez, who was then in charge, invited other leaders in the Americas to do the same and to withdraw from the Inter-American human rights system because he said it was sort of a puppet regime at the hands of the American government, which is obviously a ludicrous assertion. So we shouldn't underestimate the reverberations that can flow all the way up here in Canada from the events in Venezuela, And it does point to the need for Canada to actually stand up and do something, perhaps starting with the ratification of the American Convention on Human Rights to give the country some credibility when we criticize events such as those in Venezuela, because as it stands now, the answer inevitably is that we haven't even ratified the convention, so how can we criticize others for not fully abiding by it? So there is time for Canadian leadership, an example in this area, and hopefully the session tonight will give us some more reasons why it is urgent to move in that direction. So we will have two speakers intervening in turn. Carlos Vecchio, who is a lawyer trained in the law in Venezuela, and then at Georgetown and LLM, I think, and then further studies, I think an MPA at Harvard. He was the co-founder of Voluntad Popular, the movement and political party started by Leopoldo López, and I think is the de facto leader now of Voluntad Popular. He will be followed by Diana López, who is an artist, who is the director of an NGO called Acción por la Libertad, I think the name speaks for itself, and who also happens to be Leopoldo López' sister. We will, I think, be joined by Erwin Kotler, who probably doesn't need much of an introduction, who is a professor here, emeritus in the Faculty of Law, former Minister of Justice of Canada, and longtime international human rights advocate. So, Carlos, do you want to take the floor?
Hello, hello. Yes. Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for being here today, despite the weather. You know, I wasn't expecting any people in this room. So thank you very much. I'm coming from Florida, so you can imagine the weather there. So what I got here when I got out from the plane. So I want to thank you, the university, for this opportunity to share with us what is happening in Venezuela right now, and also all the people who participated in this organization of this seminar. So thank you very much. Before going forward, I want to just warn the following. Don't think that the way I speak English, the way I think in Spanish. Please. Please. I'll try to do my best. So keep that in mind. Unfortunately, I cannot talk in Spanish. Let me start saying to you that Leopoldo López is the leader of our political party. The political party of us, Voluntad Popular, Popular Will, is a movement of young people, people like you. When I got this room, I saw your faces, I said to me, this is Voluntad Popular. You are not the future, you are the present. And that's the way I see the young people. Because the majority of the members of Voluntad Popular are young people like you, people who are fighting for a better Venezuela. That's what we have right now. And let me tell you something, I mean, it wasn't easy to me to get here. I'm facing the same charges as Leopoldo. A year ago, we decided to go to the streets, peacefully, exercising our constitutional right. And because of that, Leopoldo López is in jail, and myself is out of Venezuela in order to denounce what is happening there. The first order of arrest when the protest started was against Leopoldo. The second one was against me. We were not expecting my order of arrest. Actually, Leopoldo, when got to the court, he used the phone of his lawyer and called me and said to me, Carlos, I'm reading your order of arrest. Please go to, you know, run away. And then we need to think what to do in this new scenario. And that's what I did. I spent 180 days in hiding. They tried once to catch me, and I had to resist 3 violent attempts of arrest in the headquarters of my political party, with a police force unprecedented in Venezuela. And they couldn't do it. And after 180 days in hiding, we had a discussion inside the political party, and we said, Carlos, you need to play a new role. You don't do anything inside of the jail with Leopoldo. Somebody has to go out internationally and have to say to the world what is happening in Venezuela. This is like a soccer team. We have forward, we have middle, we have defenders. So everyone has a role to play. Leopoldo has a role to play. Myself has a role to play. Let me tell you something. I mean, this was a very, very complex discussion inside of my political party. And for me, it has been the most difficult decision that I have ever taken in my life. I couldn't understand why I had to leave my country in the way I did, in a risky operation, because of the way that I'm thinking politically. That's not the Venezuelan that we deserve. That's not the world that we want. And I cried when I was leaving my country. Yes, I cried. If you don't cry for your country, you don't love your country. But that pushed me to reaffirm my belief that we need a new Venezuela, a better Venezuela. And for me, this situation is giving me force to continue the fight until we reach the Venezuela that we deserve. And that's why I'm here today, to talk about the Venezuela and to talk about our fight and to ask you to help us to restore democracy in Venezuela and to protect human rights in Venezuela. So thank you very much for being here today. So, let me just, I will try to go fast with the presentation because I want to have the opportunity to talk with you, to share with you instead of, you know, giving only one presentation. And I will just give you an overview about why we were protesting in Venezuela, then how the government reacted. Third, what has happened since then until now, because it's going to be a year, and the scenarios that I see in 2015. So I will start saying why we were protesting. And the main reason, I remember during these days, last year, in February, discussing with Leopoldo, saying, 2013 we ended with the highest inflation in the world. The highest inflation of the world. We had one of the highest problems of scarcity, or the shortage of basic goods, toilet paper, shampoo, milk, chicken, you name it. We had the most violent year of our history, close to 25,000 homicides. The majority of those were people like you. People like you today in Venezuela don't have future. And that's why we got in contact with the student movement to call and to your urge the Venezuelan people to protest peacefully for their rights. And that's what we did. And the last one that you see in the slide is because of the restriction of liberties. If you want to buy a product, you cannot buy it because you don't find it, or you have certain limitation. If you want to find information through the media, looking or searching for TVs or radio, you don't find it because the government has control all the majority media in Venezuela. You know which one is the most important media in Venezuela right now for us? Guess. Twitter. That's the way we communicate. If you want to do a press conference, so you use your cell phone and put your ideas right there. So we were also fighting for liberties. These are the reasons why we went to the street. We were alerting the Venezuelan that the situation would have been or will be worse in 2015. Say we were saying, this is what happened in 2013. If the situation remains as it is, 2014 and 2015 will be even worse. And that's why we said, as a political leader, we cannot stay silent. We need to speak up. We need to fight for what we believe. And we joined with the student movement. And we called for a demonstration. The first one, the big one, was in February 12th. It was huge. We were not expecting too many people there. And it was not only in the capital. It was across the country, in the most important cities in Venezuela. And we said to us, okay, something was happening inside of our society. People are asking for change. And we need to motivate that. But that day, the march was peacefully from the beginning until the end. But then suddenly, the police force of the government appeared and killed three people that day, two of them students. And immediately, the same night, the government said, Leopoldo, you are the killer. That night. Days before, everybody knew that was the government who killed the students of the people that day. And that event caused the subsequent protest that you probably know. So that was the reason why we were protesting. So how the government reacted, which is the next slide, which is very important, was the most brutal repression in our history. More than 3,000 detentions, mainly students. 2,000 of them, today, they have open trial, criminal trial, with severe limitation. For example, those people cannot go to the street and protest. They cannot tweet. They cannot talk about their cases. They cannot defend themselves in the media. They cannot go to the street and do political actions. And they are, you know, if you have that criminal open trial, in any time you can be back in jail. You know what I'm saying? So the government is saying, okay, I'm watching you. I have this in my hand. So if I push this button, you will go back to the jail. They put Leopoldo. Leopoldo today is the most important opposition political leader in Venezuela. He's in jail right now. But also the government decided to put in jail two mayors who were elected through the popular vote. So they removed them illegally and they put those mayors in jail. Also, they removed a congressman illegally. And now she has been indicted for conspiracy for the government. We have, and Diana is going to talk about those cases. We have torture cases that she will refer to. Young people like you, students, they are in common prisons and they have been tortured by the government. And Diana is going to give you details about this. People like you. So why the government did this? Especially Maduro, which is the person who is in power right now. The regime wanted to send a clear message because they know the crisis that they are facing. They were saying this following message. If the students want to go to the street, they are going to jail. And that's why they put some students in jail. And that's why they were torturing some students. If any political leader or political party want to go to the street, Leopoldo is in jail. Look, Leopoldo, that is going to happen to you. If any mayor of any city want to protest against the government, I will remove you and I will put you in jail. Also the Congress. So that was a clear message of repression, intimidation, terror. It's a Cuban script. Following, you know, a Cuban message. They were trying to intimidate the Venezuelan with this repression. And something which is worse, and I will talk a little bit about it, that repression is still ongoing and is even worse, as we will see. So let me show you a short video, just to give you a flavor, not only words, but also image and video about the repression and the protests in Venezuela. It's very short. So you see a little bit of what I was saying and also the lines in order to get products in Venezuela, chicken, milk, whatever. So if we continue with the presentation, I want to give you some facts. So what has happened since the protest until now and what we were and what we will face in 2015. The economic and political and social problems are still there. In our view, they are even worse. We ended this 2014 with the highest inflation in the world, again. It is even higher than the previous one. And if you look, that indicator in food is 100%, close to 100%. So it's going to be very, very difficult, the economic situation for the Venezuela. The scarcity problem, as you saw the lines, they are huge. Why? Because the model that this government wanted to implement didn't work. It's a Cuban model, basically, just to give you a brief. We destroyed the economic capacity of Venezuela. They don't believe in the private sector. They don't believe how you can work with the private sector and the public sector. They want to control all the entire economy. We import almost everything what we consume in Venezuela, close to 70%. We were using the oil in order to buy the food abroad. And those problems that you were watching, we had those problems having the highest oil prices in our history, $100 per barrel. And now that the oil prices went down, so the problem will be even worse because we won't have enough money to import the food that we need as a country. So that's what we are facing right now. So that's why we believe the situation will be even worse. Repression. That's the tool the government is using because they know the situation. They want to stop the people. They want to stop the people. They don't want to see the people on the street claiming or blaming the government. The violation against human rights or against the people is still there and will continue. The government wanted to manipulate with a dialogue without result. Just they wanted only to stop protests on the street last year. That didn't work. The government doesn't want to talk with the opposition. Actually, they don't see us as opposition. They see us as enemies that they have to destroy. That's the government that we have in power right now. The most important human rights organizations have released reports about Venezuela, reports about the human rights violation, reports about the Leopoldo case, the tortures. So that gives us support when we talk in the international community saying, it's not my word. It's not my word. Now we have independent institutions as the Human Rights Organization and also the UN saying that there is a clear violation of human rights in Venezuela. We have to pay attention to that. And we were asking, because when we go to those institutions, we said to them, don't believe in us. Why don't you go to Venezuela and you verify what I'm saying? Let's look for an independent organization to check or to test what we are saying. You know what? The government doesn't want those organizations in Venezuela. They doesn't allow them to go to Venezuela, even the UN. And we are part of the UN. The most important organization is asking for the release of Leopoldo. Leopoldo has been considered a political prisoner of conscience. He's in jail because of his ideas. And the majority of this organization, countries, personalities around the world are asking for the release of Leopoldo. He has become the icon of this fight and the icon of the political prisoners. He knows that if he is out, the rest of the political prisoners will be also out of jail. There is no separation of power in Venezuela. We don't have the opportunity to go to the judicial branch or anywhere to get any protection from the rest of the institution of Venezuela. All of them are controlled by the government, manipulating the constitution. They have elected this year the electoral, the judicial, and what we call citizen branch, which is the attorney general and the controller and a public defender. Fine. Yes. Okay. So we don't have separation of power. And that's why, in my view, there is a lack of democracy in Venezuela. If I want to be clear with you, I must say that we don't have democracy. We are facing a new form of dictatorship of the 21st century. If we look forward in the slides, the freedom of the speech is totally limited. They started closing the medias. They passed different acts to control the media. They intimidated all the journalists, the owner of those media. But you know now what they did last year? They understood that the political cost was too high, closing a media. You know what they did? They bought. Using the money of the government, they bought the most important independent TVs and newspapers in Venezuela. And that's why now we don't have any, just small windows, I should say only internet, to send our message. So, as I said to you, the oil prices went down. That will continue this year. Let me show you some numbers just to finish with this. The popularity of Maduro. Sorry, the people in Venezuela. Click the other one. No. Go back and just show what I want to point it out. That I want to point out that 80% right now, 81% of the Venezuelan people right now is saying that the Venezuelan situation is negative. It's negative. It's bad. They are blaming Maduro. Close to 80% of the people is saying that Maduro's administration is not good for the country. And the popularity, continue with the other one. Close to 70% disapproves Maduro's administration, and the other one, which is the popularity of Maduro, went down. And this is the opposition. For the first time, the opposition is bigger than the official bloc or the official political party. And the popularity of Maduro went down to 22%. So this year, we will have Maduro in a very difficult situation for the lack of political leadership. He doesn't have political leadership to manage or to handle this situation. The economic situation and the social problems will be there and will be even worse. So people will be, in our view, on the street again, and they will try to stop them using repression. Continue with the other one. The majority of the people recognizes what I'm saying, that the government is responsible for the crisis. The majority of the people, in our view, is looking for a change. And the main challenge that we have as opposition is not only to preserve the opposition, but also those Venezuelans who work with the government, who are blaming the government, we need them to our side. And that's the main challenge that we have as the opposition. You can see the pictures. The scarcity will continue. It's even worse this month. The inflation in food is, as I said to you, 100%. You can see the lines in order to get products. So that's the social problem that we have. This is the rank of inflation. We are again on the top. Continue. So at the end of the day, what we are doing is trying not only to protect human rights, which is a key element of our fight, and that's why we need the international community, but also to restore democracy in Venezuela, the democratic coexistence. That doesn't exist right now. And we need the majority of Venezuela work on that. And I'm putting there part of the Chavismo or the opposition political party, the official political party need to be from this side. Internationally, in our view, it's more clear that there is a violation of human rights in Venezuela. The international community is now, I must say, clear on what is happening. But we need action from them. In our view, the international community will continue pushing the release of Leopoldo from jail. He has been very, very, very strong. And the international community has to write his voice in this fight. Human rights, in our view, don't have a nationality, don't have borders. And that's why we need to speak out internationally. The eyes of the international community has to be in Venezuela. And we need you. We need you to protect and to defend human rights in Venezuela. I will end with this. I want to thank you for being here today. I want to ask you to join us in this beautiful fight to restore democracy in our country and to protect human rights in Venezuela. Thank you very much for being here. Thanks.
Hello? Hello, Mr. Kotler. Can you hear me? Yes. Well, good evening. Thank you, everybody, for being here. You can imagine how important it is for us to have a full room and to have your support and to have your willingness to hear our story. I want to thank especially the Center of Human Rights and Legal Pluralism of McGill. I want to thank the director, Colleen Shepherd. I want to thank Nandini, René Provost, who is here with us, Robert Leakey, and, of course, Mr. Kotler, who made a big, big effort to come from Ottawa today. Thank you so much. And to the team that has put this together, Mariela Tobar, Claudia Flamant, Carla, Carlos, who are students here and have given us a lot of support. For me, I'm here as a citizen, as a Venezuelan citizen, as a witness of what has happened in Venezuela since last year, since the protests of 2014. I was thinking that a year ago I would have never been asked to come to a law institution, to a university, to talk about human rights. My life, as the life of many Venezuelans, changed after February 2014. I'm an artist. I work in culture. I promote art and culture of Venezuela. Usually I have been invited to universities to talk about that. So for me, it's very sad to bring the images and the stories that I'm going to bring today. Usually I like to talk about the beautiful things that happen in Venezuela. Today is different. I have to talk about the tragedy of our lives right now in Venezuela. So I want to start with showing a video that has very tough images, and as I say, I wish I wouldn't have to show it today. I need some help. Maybe Clara can help, because I don't know where do I have to, maybe here for the video. Okay.
No?
Not yet.
Comenzó como una protesta estudiantil por el intento de violación dentro de una universidad a un estudiante del estado Táchira. Esto fue el detonante de una serie de protestas estudiantiles en esa parte del país. Con la detención de varios de los estudiantes por manifestar, se intensificó la protesta y se unieron muchas de las principales ciudades del país, incluyendo la capital, Caracas. A esa protesta estudiantil se sumaron otras muchas quejas que tenía la sociedad civil en general. Escasez de productos básicos, corrupción gubernamental y violaciones a los derechos humanos. De estas marchas resultaron los tres primeros muertos y numerosos heridos. Tres personas asesinadas con disparos a la cabeza el 12 de febrero, luego de una marcha promovida por los estudiantes para pedir a la Fiscalía General de la República la liberación de los estudiantes detenidos. Días después aparecieron videos en los que se veía a funcionarios policiales disparando contra los manifestantes, incluso mostrando el momento exacto de la muerte de uno de ellos. Ya van varias semanas de distintas expresiones por parte de los manifestantes y de represión sistemática por parte del gobierno y grupos armados apoyados por él. Entonces, ¿qué pasa en Venezuela? Violaciones a los derechos humanos. El Foro Penal Venezolano es una organización sin fines de lucro conformada por una red de abogados de todo el país que se ha dedicado desde el principio a asistir legalmente a los manifestantes frente a la gran cantidad de detenciones y abusos por parte del gobierno nacional y a defender a quienes han sufrido de alguna manera violaciones a sus derechos humanos.
Estamos viviendo en la peor crisis histórica de detenciones, o la mayor cantidad de detenciones que existe históricamente en el país.
Los abusos y violaciones por parte de los cuerpos policiales y Guardia Nacional en Venezuela van desde el uso de gases tóxicos y en exceso frente a manifestantes desarmados y en zonas residenciales donde habitan personas mayores y niños, pasando por disparos de perdigones a muy corta distancia de los manifestantes con una intención clara de hacerles daño, causándole así heridas graves, lesiones de gran magnitud o hasta la muerte, como en el caso de Geraldine Moreno, quien muere por un disparo de perdigones a la cara. También se ha demostrado el uso indebido de armamento no autorizado para repeler manifestaciones pacíficas e incluso se ha hablado de presencia de cuerpos policiales no destinados al trato de este tipo de manifestaciones y de grupos de civiles armados disparando a manifestantes apoyados por los cuerpos policiales y militares. Estas son nuestras denuncias. Estos son sus testimonios.
Mi hijo fue vilmente maltratado, humillado, violado, vejado.
Tenía en posición fetal, arrodillado con la que yo metí mi cabeza y yo le hice mucho meter la cabeza y entre las piernas.
Primero fue bajarme los boxers y penetrarme.
Desde un principio que me estaban golpeando, dije que me iban a violar.
Literalmente en ese momento nos estaban saltando en la cabeza a nosotros, la Guardia Nacional. Estaban saltando solo en nuestra cabeza, nos estaban golpeando con la escopeta, nos pateaban, todo. Siempre nos decían que nos iban a matar, que nos iban a violar, que no íbamos a ver a nuestras familias.
Yo me siento es violada, herida, maltratada, humillada, vejada, todo por una Guardia Nacional, dos funcionarios de ellos mismos que me patearon hasta que quisieron.
Bueno, nos amenazaron de muerte, nos amenazaron de violaciones, nos amenazaron de cortarnos las manos, los brazos. Y un montón de cosas que sencillamente nadie debe escuchar, y mucho menos en ese momento tan vulnerable en el que todos mis compañeros fueron golpeados brutalmente.
Torturado por los medios de este país, los medios de seguridad, por el SEBIN, señores. Fue torturado por más de 4 o 5 horas, con descargas de corriente en todo su cuerpo, hasta caer desmayado una y otra vez.
I know many of you have seen videos like this in the internet. This is not the only video. There are many ONGs that are working to denounce what is happening right now in Venezuela. I wanted to bring this video in particular, made by Foro Penal, because they too are being persecuted. One of the lawyers that works in Foro Penal is now in prison. They are victims, just like the protesters, just for defending the people who want to protest. As Aung San Suu Kyi said, under authoritarian governments, dissent may be a crime. Definitely in Venezuela, to think differently is a crime. These images that you just saw are from 2014. Now, in 2015, the Minister of Defense said that they are allowed to use lethal weapons, deadly weapons, in the protest. Where can that be in the 21st century? In what country is there allowed to use lethal weapons against their own population? This is what's happening in Venezuela. It just happened last week. So it's legal for our government right now, for the Maduro regime, to kill people in the protest. Every country has people who protest for different reasons. It is a human right to dissent from the government. People in Venezuela have the right to protest. We have the right to protest first for the right of life, because Venezuela is one of the most violent countries in South America, in Latin America. So we have the right to protest just for that reason, just for the life of the people, of us. We have the right to protest for health, for education, for to be able to travel through the country. There are many reasons why students and why people are protesting. The protests didn't start in 2014. They started long years ago, but they have just increased because the situation in our country has been deteriorating on and on. Not only students protest, also regular citizens go out and protest because they have the pain of their children who don't have opportunities in our country. Also the mothers, the grandmothers. And this is the repression is happening not just in the city of Caracas, but in all the cities. This was Basil da Costa. He was the first student who was killed last year. He was killed on the 12th of February. I really have to say he can be any of us. He was just a student who decided to go out that day and he didn't go back to his house. Now his mother is alone, but not only alone. She doesn't have even the, ¿cómo se dice los culpables? The guilty. There's no, the trial hasn't even started to find out who is responsible for Basil's death. This is Robert Redman. That same day, the 12th of February, he was also killed. His father says he didn't want to be a hero. He just wanted to protest for his rights. This is Genesis Carmona. Just a couple days later, she was killed in the city of Valencia. Like them, it's 43 people who were killed in this protest, and there are no answers to their families for who committed those crimes. There are proofs that those crimes were committed by the guards, by the police forces, and by the paramilitary who are also that work with the government. So imagine the pain of each of those families. There's also been torture and abuse in the protest. This is Marvinia Jimenez. She was assaulted by the Bolivarian Guard, and now they say she's guilty for protesting. This is Marcelo Crobato. Marcelo Crobato is a member of Foro Penal, the video that you just saw. He wanted to defend the students who were protesting, and for defending them, now he's been in prison since April of last year. He's the father of two, he has a family, and he's in a very complicated health situation, and in December he attempted to commit suicide. The government has no answer for Marcelo Crovato or his family. This is Rosamund Mantilla. He's a friend of mine. He worked with me in culture. He's an activist. He's an activist for gay rights. And one night, the SEBIM, the police, went into his home. He used to live with his grandparents, and they took him. They took him. They say he was helping the protest, and he couldn't be free. He was arrested, and his trial has been deferred 11 times. 11 times. Justice, there's no justice for Rosamund. He's in El Sabin since May of last year. This is Daniel Ceballos. He's a young politician who has a dream of a better Venezuela. He's a professional. He loves his country. He loves his city, San Cristobal. He was elected mayor in December of 2014. By April, in December 2013. In April 2014, he was arrested. They say he was rebellious, that he could not be a mayor. He's been in prison. He's in prison in Ramo Verde, a military prison, away from his family. He has three young children who live in San Cristobal, and he's in prison in Caracas. This is Gilberto. Gilberto Soho is an activist. He directs a program for elder people. It's called Casa de los Abuelos in San Agustin, in a poor barrio of Caracas. He's always very enthusiastic. I know him personally. And he and his wife were arrested one night with their three-year-old daughter and taken to El Sebin. El Sebin, El Helicoide, is a horrible prison that wasn't meant to be a prison. It's just a space that was converted into a prison. They took the three of them, including their three-year-old child. And the mother, Carolina, and their daughter were with Gilberto for 35 hours until they let them free, but Gilberto is still in prison. And we have no information about his trial. This is María Elena Euskategui. She was helping the protesters. She took water and food for the protesters. For that reason, she was in prison. Now she's under house arrest with terrible health conditions and with 20 pounds less. This is Christian Holdak. Christian is a photographer and a student, a graphic design student. He has no political affiliation. On the 12th of February of last year, he decided to go to the protest like thousands of us who were there, and he was taking photographs. And for taking photographs, he was in prison that day, and he's still in prison in a very delicate condition. I think I could talk about many more people. There are 63 people with cases that are similar like this. I'm sure that they remind you of people that are similar to you. Some are mothers, some are students, people who just want to have their voice heard, and the government put them in prison. My brother's one of them. My brother is a political leader. He has the dream of a better Venezuela. He wants a just Venezuela. He wants a democratic Venezuela. And he knows it can happen because he knows that other countries have gone through difficult histories, difficult situations. But if we unite as a population and we demand our rights, eventually we'll get that democracy. But the sacrifice has been big. He, as Carlos narrated, he went out on the 12th of February to protest. It was a student protest because the 12th of February is the day of the youth in Venezuela. So the students were the ones who called for the protest, and many political leaders, as Carlos, as Maria Corina Machado, as Antonio Ledesma, as Leopoldo, went with the students to protest. But the government, who have been persecuting my brother for 10 years, this is not new. For 10 years, different ways, with trials, with not letting him run for mayor, with a discredit against him, they decided that, as Maduro said, it was time for him to go to jail. And he said, Leopoldo, I have your jail ready for you. And what he wanted, what the government wanted, was that Leopoldo would leave the country. They said, oh, he's just going to run away. No, Leopoldo said, no, I'm not going to leave the country. I'm going to face you directly in the eye. I'm going to face justice, even though it is unjust, until things change. Things have to change. So on the 18th, Leopoldo decided to hand himself in. I have to tell you, as a sister, I was deeply afraid. Deeply afraid. I thought my brother that day could get killed. That's what I thought. Because there's so much violence in our country that that was a possibility. Thank God that didn't happen. But now he is in jail. And he's facing a very unfair trial. These were his words that day. If my imprisonment contributes to the awakening of the people, and if it helps Venezuela to awake once and for all, so that most of us who want a change may build that change in peace and democracy, then it will have been worth it. Peace and democracy. He always, as Carlos Vecchio, as Maria Corina Machado, as many leaders and many students, have always said, a peaceful protest. We are pacifists. We believe in non-violent demonstrations, and we want to achieve democracy. But for believing that way, for thinking that way, he is in prison as many others. This was almost a year ago when he was handing himself in. In the picture you cannot see, but he had a flower in his hand, and the people were all dressed in white, symbolizing peace. This is a self-portrait Leopoldo did. I'm an artist, and that's what I can offer him. When I go to visit him, I teach him how to draw. He has a lot of time, so he now is, I think he's starting to draw and paint very well. I wanted to bring you that of him. I have never shown it in public, so I think he's doing very well. Leopoldo is isolated. He's in a cell in Ramo Verde, a military prison, and he should have the right to get visitors, as prisoners do. But Leopoldo is not allowed to receive any visitors except for his direct family. His direct family, as they understand, is his parents, his wife, his children, and his sister. That's it. That and his lawyers are the only people allowed to have direct contact with Leopoldo. So he's in complete isolation. As experts say, to be in isolation is a way of torture. So my brother is being tortured. He's being tortured for that reason. He's being tortured because they throw excrement in his jail and then cut off the water so he cannot clean himself. That's torture. Sometimes in the middle of the night, guards come in, all dressed in black with arms and ski mask, and throw in the ground all his books and push him around and take his notes because he writes his own defense. I mean, he has a lawyer, but he also writes his defense. They take away those notes from him. So it's another way of torture. So like all the other prisoners, Leopoldo is being tortured. He is not having a fair trial. When the lawyers go to visit him, they don't have the confidentiality that they should be allowed. The meetings are not private, and many times they're being taped. The trial should be a public trial. That's what our constitution say. It's not public. When we get there to the, they call it the Palace of Justice. I would call it the Palace of Injustice. When we arrive there, when he has trial, the whole building is surrounded by hundreds of military men that don't allow people to go in except the people that are going to that trial. It's very difficult to get to that audience room. So the trial is not public. Journalists are not allowed in, and of course not regular people can go in there. So it's... every day we see more and more and more violations of rights in the case of Leopoldo. And I'm sure I wanted to bring the other faces because Leopoldo is one of all the one symbol of the rest. And Leopoldo always tells me when I visit him, Diana, please always talk about all of us. Don't just talk about my case. Please let the people know that this is a problem against all of Venezuelans. This can happen to anyone. Just as it happened even to some people who were doing Twitter. There are 7 people right now who are in jail for tweeting messages against the government. So, as I said before, a year ago, I thought I would be dedicating my time to art and culture, as I, that's what I like to do, that's what I'm prepared to do, but my life changed. So a group of us decided to do a project which is called Acción por la Libertad, Action for Liberty. What we have done in this first year is document what is going on in these cases. We do a newsletter every week and we send it out with different articles about what is going on and different data in order to let people know what's going on. This is one of the bulletins. The last one, we're already number 43. I thought in my mind, in my innocent mind, that maybe we were going to do 10 or 20 and then this nightmare was going to end. We're now in bulletin 43. For today, I promised Claudia and Mariela that I would have the version in English. We think it is very important that the English-speaking people also know what's going on in Venezuela, so today we started sending out this newsletter. And when we were thinking, well, how can, maybe you're saying, well, how can we help? We're in Montreal, we're far away, we cannot go out and protest, or maybe you can. You could protest in front of the consulate or the embassy. And I know that many of you protested last year, 2014. You help us from Montreal, from Canada, help give us energy to Venezuela by protesting here. It was exciting to see pictures of this city all snowed with Venezuelan flags and all of you freezing and protesting. That gives us the energy we need to keep going. Another way that I wanted to invite you was to letting people know the testimonies of the victims. A friend, Roberto Mata, who is a photographer, he did testimonies, 21 testimonies of different victims. This is one. This is Esther, and she was wounded in one of the protests, and she tells her story. So these are in Instagram. You can take them down, and you can share it with your friends. We have these books that we did, but we cannot share it with all of you, but we can show you around. Yeah, you can pass them around. Because we think it's important that these faces of these people, these stories, the stories are shared. This is a way you can help us. I want to finish by saying some words of Oscar Arias. As you know, Oscar Arias was president of Costa Rica, Nobel Prize. And he said, he wrote an article last week or 2 weeks ago about Venezuela. And he said something very important. This is not about a problem about left or right. This is a problem of democracy. So in Venezuela, we have a crisis in democracy, and we have to unite all our forces to fight for liberty. When you fight, when you don't have liberty in one community, in one city, in one country, the liberty of everybody is at risk. Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to be able to be here to hear the witness testimonies. And when you hear Diana Lopez's testimony and Carlos Vecchio's testimony, then you appreciate the dimensions and the depths of the massive domestic repression in Venezuela, the widespread and systematic violation of human rights, the denial of the rule of law, the culture of corruption and impunity, etc., all the things that they have put so compellingly and graphically before you. And I'm delighted that they will be in Ottawa tomorrow to testify before our Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on International Human Rights so that parliamentarians can get a better appreciation and understanding of what is happening in Venezuela. And this brings me to the particular points that I want to share with you today. The question that I want to put is really, you know, what can Canada, what can Canadian parliamentarians, what can you do in order to advance the case and cause of Leopoldo López and the cause of human rights and democracy and the rule of law in Venezuela? And for reasons of time, because I've been cautioned by my colleague René Provost with regard to time, I'm going to leave out all the things I was going to do because it's no longer necessary about analyzing what happened in Venezuela. You have all the, as I say, the witness testimony best put forward without any derivative testimony from myself. I'm just going to speak mainly to the question of action, and I'm going to try to do that through the prism of the Leopoldo López case as a case study of how to mobilize awareness, understanding, and action. And I hope you'll pardon me for doing it in point form, but again, for reasons of time. And the first thing is we need to engage and involve the Canadian government in the overall, as I say, awareness and action with what is happening in Venezuela. I have to tell you that, frankly, the Canadian government, Venezuela, is not on the radar screen of the Canadian government. They are involved and preoccupied with issues relating to ISIS, with regarding to international terrorism. I can go on. Venezuela, regrettably, is not on the radar screen, though it should be a foreign policy priority for us for all the reasons that you can appreciate. So we have tried to use the Leopoldo López case because when you put a face on what is going on, when you put a particular appreciation of the pain and plight of political prisoners using Leopoldo López as a case study, then you can somehow connect with the government. So we had Leon Tintori, Leopoldo's wife, come to Parliament in November, meet with our Foreign Affairs Minister, John Baird, which resulted in him making the first real public statement for advocacy and action on behalf of the Canadian government, and that served as the beginning of a wake-up call for the Canadian government. I have a few other recommendations on this particular point. I'll even go to the second one, and that is involvement of the Canadian Parliament and Canadian parliamentarians. Here, too, Leopoldo López's case has proven to be a kind of mobilizing framework for our advocacy. We had, as I said, the presence of Lillian Tintori and Jared Genzer, who's been the counsel for Leopoldo López. I work with him as co-counsel, but he has been the principal counsel. They came, they testified before our Foreign Affairs Subcommittee. They met with parliamentarians, as a result of which we've established an all-party parliamentary committee on behalf of Leopoldo López. We held a press conference in November. Unfortunately, it coincided with the very day that there were allegations of sexual harassment against certain parliamentarians, so very few came to our press conference. And as I spoke to the media, I said to them, I thought that you guys can walk and chew gum at the same time. They said, no, we have another story like we had. We're sorry we couldn't get it. But we're going to have another press conference tomorrow. I have to say here, too, the Canadian press has been lagging way behind our American counterparts. You've had the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street, et cetera, writing not only major news stories, but writing supportive editorials. You can scan the Canadian media. You won't find it. We're hoping that that can happen, and here's where you yourselves can engage in terms of social media, your own op-ed writing, and begin to help engage the media. The third point here in this regard is for the Canadian government and... Okay. The third point is to involve the Canadian government and the Canadian Parliament to use our bilateral relationship, our commercial relationship and leverage with regard to Venezuela, but all the institutions, the OAS, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the Inter-American Charter, et cetera, to leverage what is happening in Venezuela, to help mobilize the international community in that regard, and to enact sanctions. We should be enacting sanctions against the human rights violators in Venezuela the way the American Congress recently did, in terms of identifying those people who have been the major human rights violators, the main people involved in domestic repression, and invoke travel bans, asset seizures, including those that may be here in Canada and have assets here in Canada. A fourth approach, and that is to internationalize the advocacy, and that is to build an international critical mass of advocacy on behalf of Leopoldo López, and through the looking glass of his case, a critical mass of international advocacy with regard to what is happening and the need for addressing the human rights violations in Venezuela. And here we have made representations to and received support from the European Parliament, Latin American parliamentarians, UN agencies, the UN Commissioner on Human Rights, President Obama, etc. We have not had as much in terms of Canada in that regard. And again, I emphasize that we need to ratchet up the Canadian leadership in this approach. Fifth is the mobilization of the media. I made reference to that, and here you guys can make a real contribution to that. The sixth thing is UN agencies. We petitioned the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. They came up with a finding of fact, a conclusion of law, that Leopoldo López's detention has been arbitrary, illegal, called immediately for his release. This is something that we can build on. As well, we have made representations to the six UN special rapporteurs. There are UN special rapporteurs on human rights defenders, on arbitrary detention, on freedom of expression. I can go on. And we are seeking now to get the six UN special rapporteurs to issue a joint statement calling for his release and building upon, as I say, the decision of the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. A seventh thing is we have prepared a legal brief, a very compelling, documented witness testimony and legal analysis of the violations of the human rights of Leopoldo López in this case, which serve as a case study for the violations of all the other political prisoners. And Leopoldo López said he will not leave prison until all the political prisoners are released. This white paper is something particularly law students can use. It's close to 100 pages of detailed, comprehensive, documented witness testimony and legal analysis with the kind of footnoted things that I thought I had gotten away from in no longer being a law professor. But this is something that I think you guys can use in terms of an advocacy brief in that regard. An eighth thing is making representations, and we are doing so to interparliamentary groups like the Interparliamentary Union, Liberal International. A ninth is working with NGOs, again, to build up a critical mass of involvement by civil society and the principal NGOs, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Advancing Human Rights Freedom Now, all those with whom we have been working in this regard. The tenth, and moving to a close, making representations to bar associations, because we've got to engage the Canadian Bar Associations, provincial bar associations. I'll be meeting with the Law Society of Upper Canada next week, with the Quebec Bar and so on, to engage the legal community in the cases of the political prisoners in Venezuela, and again, using Leopoldo López's case, because it's a classic case study in that regard. Finally, making direct representations to Venezuela, to its government and the like. And may I close just by saying that none of this could have been possible without the courageous involvement of Leopoldo López's family with regard to his mother, his sister. The whole family has been engaged, and the Venezuelan diaspora. And I want to pay tribute to the Venezuelan diaspora, some of whom are also coming tomorrow, the leadership of the diaspora, who will be appearing before the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee, meeting with Canadian parliamentarians and the like. And in terms of what you here in the law school can do, let me just close with several suggestions, one-liners, really. When I was a law professor here, we used to every year take on the case of a political prisoner. And we'd mobilize the law school community on behalf of that political prisoner to engage in all the things that I've been mentioning and the like. We did this with Anatoly Sharansky, who was in the former Soviet Union. We did it with regard to Nelson Mandela. I want to suggest you take on the case of Leopoldo Lopez. Make this a case where this McGill Law School, the McGill community, adopts Leopoldo Lopez as a political prisoner and makes case and cause on his behalf. As well, there is a... There is a procedure in Parliament whereby a parliamentarian can table a petition that is signed by 25 people and table it in Parliament, and when it's tabled in Parliament, can make a statement on the behalf of that petition and the like. All I can say is you have amongst you here groups of people who can organize petitions. Give it not just to me, to other parliamentarians. Every time a parliamentarian tables that petition, he or she can make a statement about it. Every time I make a statement about it, that thing goes into the record. Not that Hansard is a bestseller, but I'm just saying it's another way of mobilization of awareness and action. Use the social media, do op-eds, as I mentioned, work with the Venezuelan diaspora, and as Diana said, use the testimonies. These testimonies are really the best evidence we have as to the massive repression going on in Venezuela and our individual and collective responsibility to address it, redress it, and bring about democratization and human rights for the Venezuelan people. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We will make some time for a question and answer, and I would ask if you have questions to go to one of the two microphones because the event is being recorded, so we need to hear your questions. We will take, if there are several, we will take several questions and then allow the panelists to react to them. We could start here with this gentleman.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. My name is Moses, and I am a second-year law student here at the faculty. Thank you very much for the wonderful presentations. I thought that was amazing. And thank you also for Professor Kotler for coming and all the presenters. So I was wondering, in addition to, well, not in addition to, but other sorts of, in addition to, you know, public disobedience or civil disobedience, what sorts of other mechanisms were used to bring forth the plight of the Venezuelan people? Because I'm thinking in terms of, you know, what other means used, you know, trying to talk to the government, what else is being done bring about democratization in Venezuela, because as Professor Kotler mentioned, I knew what was going on in Venezuela, but I had no deep knowledge because of, you know, the other sort of like international crisis going on with ISIL, and so what sorts of other means are being used? And also, I want to tell you that I'm also joining in the cause. I think it's a worthy cause. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll take another question on the other side.
First of all, thanks a lot for coming here. We're very grateful for your testimony. So this is more than a Latin American fight or Venezuelan fight. So a Latin American fight is also a global fight, of course. And we all know that you know, Chavez and Maduro and their party and other participants of the Sao Paulo Forum have their grip now all over Latin America. Bolivia with Evo Morales and Peru and Brazil with Lula and now Dilma. So my question is, would the situation have been different in Venezuela hadn't a major player like Brazil, for example, given support to the regime? And what can we do from abroad, and what can Canada do, what can the United States do, and, you know, the international community do to put pressure not only on the regime, but bring awareness also to the problem that's more all-encompassing and more general than just the human rights violations. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're actually going to take those two questions, and then we're going to have to stop there after we've allowed the speakers to respond, because the room was booked until about 3 minutes ago, so there's a limit to the university's patience. So we'll have to, those two people can ask their questions, and then we'll let the speakers react.
Yes, I'd like to ask two questions to address the causes of this social morass. One of them, first of all, is I'd like to draw parallels to what has emerged in Venezuela and what we've seen over the past couple of months in Peru in particular, because we have the same social destabilization, which really took hold, especially when students' social assistance was taken away. I'd like to know whether you see the situation evolving in the same manner. The second one, geopolitical, economic in a sense, this question of multiple exchange rates from the 6.5 to the bolivars, to the dollars, to 150, and I believe there are four different ones. They want to compress two of them into one. We know the effects on foreign companies is substantial. It drives them away. It forces them to devalue their assets in Venezuela. But I'd like all of you to expound on how these multiple exchange rates are impacting the population in the country, every individual. So if you can expound on that, I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And last question to the lady.
Yes. My question is about leadership and the future. You said yourself, Mr. Vecchio, that Leopoldo López now is kind of like the leader of the opposition movement. And there, you know, in the past few years, there has been a lot more focus on him than there used to be focus on Enrique Capriles, who was the one that, you know, won the primaries and went against Chavez and Maduro in two elections and, you know, garnered an unprecedented amount of votes towards the opposition movement of those people who, you know, are disappointed with the government, and it's the same people who, you know, were looking at Chavez to be like their only hope when he first ran, the people who had been disappointed with the politics in Venezuela for 40 years previous. And so I wanted to know, like, in your opinion, like, is there a political rationale behind focusing the leadership of the opposition more towards Leopoldo López, or is that just something that kind of happened? Thank you.
Okay, so thank you. So I think maybe we'll go in the order of the presentation. So let's start with Carlos.
You know that when I took this role to go out internationally and try to denounce what is happening in Venezuela, I understood something very clear, very clear. Me as a leader or as a political leader in Venezuela won't change the mind of the Canadian government, for example, or any other government. What I understood clearly is that if you engage the Canadians, people like you, to convince your government in favor of our cause, then you will get a result. You know what I'm saying? I mean, the Prime Minister of Canada won't pay attention to me, but will pay attention to you. And that's what we need to understand and use that to mobilize the community in any particular country in order to move the government of that country. So keeping that in mind, there are thousands of mechanisms that we can use in order to produce that. Professor Kotler just said many of them, and I agree with all of them. And I will add, you know, some ideas. We cannot forget that Venezuela is in this region. It's in America. And we are, in my view, playing the destiny of democracy in the region in Venezuela. And we need to pay attention to that. Canada is part of the UN. So the government of Venezuela doesn't allow to the UN to visit Venezuela in order to verify the violation of human rights. So we need to push Canada to help us in the UN to force that a UN commission could visit Venezuela in order to verify what we are doing, that we are saying outside. We have a resolution which asks for the release of Leopoldo. We need Canada to push that in the UN, to force the Venezuelan government to comply with that resolution. Canada, if I'm right, is part of the Human Rights Commission of the UN. So we need a voice there. Canada is part of the Security Council of the UN, and they can... Not yet? It's there almost?
General Assembly.
I thought it was. Okay, but it's almost there. You have, for sure, a partner there. So we could use also that mechanism in order to force the UN to comply or to raise awareness about Venezuela. You were saying that this is only about human rights and democracy. In my view, that's the most important thing. But I must say something. When you have a type of regime as we have in Venezuela, that they don't care anything but their power, just being power and do whatever they want in order to preserve power, there are a lot of corruption there. And I don't know if you have familiar with this, but recently it was denounced that the second person of the regime has been member of the drug cartel. The majority of the drugs that is produced in Colombia go through Venezuela to the rest of the world. And probably part of the drug problem that you may have here in Canada is because of the drug that you know is coming from Colombia through Venezuela. So you have an issue there. And also, if you are talking about ISIS, terrorism, well, it was a diplomat of the Venezuela which was involved with the Hezbollah. And one of the members of the official political party in Venezuela brought a lot of people from the Hezbollah to Venezuela. So we have also some things about terrorism. So other elements that we can use, that we can build in order to make our case and to raise awareness in the international community, in this case in Canada. So I believe in that. If you move the community of any particular country, then it's possible to move your government. And that's what we need from you to do. And also, something that in my view is very important, is some of you could go to Venezuela by yourself, an important representation of the government, or if Mr. Cutler could go to Venezuela to visit Leopoldo.
Try to visit Leopoldo.
That will help tremendously in our cause. Recently, we had the visit of three former Latin American presidents. Last year, I went to the Club de Madrid, which is an organization which groups a lot of close to 100 former presidents around the world. And they made a joint declaration in favor of Leopoldo. So that's what we need to do. I will end just
there.
There. I wanted to talk about the exchange regime, so privately we can just discuss it. Sorry.
I'm not an expert on economics, but since one of the questions is about the control exchange rate, and since I'm a Venezuelan and I'm also a victim because we're also victims of the economic problems, not just of human rights problems, but also of that problem, I would say that the Chavista model has failed. The Chavista model includes control of the currency exchange, control of the production, control of distribution, control of the ideology, control of they don't want any other political parties but the PCUV. So control of the society. That's the Chavista model, and it has failed. That's why we have an economic crisis, a social crisis, and a political crisis. So the government either has to change radically, which they haven't given any signs of wanting to change, or we have to change the government. Those are the two ways to improve the lives of all Venezuelans. One person also asked about what other ways do they exist other than going to protest in the streets. Well, through 15 years of having this regime, Venezuelans have tried many ways. Political parties have tried to have dialogue, and the government is not willing to have dialogue. The powers, there's no separation of powers, as Carlos explained before. So, for example, the Attorney General has been there for how many years, and she's very close to the political party. And the same in all other important positions in the government. So it is a model that has just has gone in an implosion. It's time for change.
As to what more we can do, maybe I'll just take a leaflet out of what he did. He came recently before our Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on International Human Rights to testify in matters relating to the effects and consequences of genocide in Rwanda. I would think welcome. And another initiative that you may be able to get involved in. A second thing, and this was Carlos reminded me of what we could perhaps do, and that is to expose and unmask the complicity of Venezuela and other major human rights violators. It may be that Venezuela is not on the radar screen of Canadian foreign policy, but the Korea is, Syria is, and Venezuela is implicated with each of them, either in providing support for them or in seeking to provide exculpatory immunity to them. So here's something we can do in terms of exposing and unmasking. And the final thing is for Canadian Parliament to send a delegation to Venezuela. I might add, Diane, that Jared and I are planning to go to Venezuela and to visit Leopoldo. We're working on that right now. Right now. And for the government also to sanction Venezuela for not allowing delegations to visit them or to visit Leopoldo. I just might add that just in the last 48 hours alone, the crackdown has continued in terms of Maduro arresting people in the pharmaceutical industry, arresting leaders in the supermarket industry, accusing Vice President Joseph Biden of the United States of organizing a coup against Venezuela. I mean, as we meet this kind of repression and untenable conspiracy theories, etc., of Maduro, give an example of the kind of things that we may be in store for and why it is so urgent and so important that we act now.
So I would simply invite Professor Leckie from the Center for Private and Comparative Law to just say a few words to thank all the speakers on our behalf.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the CREPO Center and the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, thank you so much to all the speakers. Thank you for coming here tonight. The law faculty at McGill is often a meeting place for people coming together to discuss justice and human rights and questions of law and human dignity, sometimes at more of a distance and other times, as tonight, more urgently. And the case of Leopoldo Lopez and others reminds us that it's extremely urgent what we're discussing tonight. When Mariella and I were talking about this event months ago, she was expressing the widely spread frustration at the sense that the Canadian media have failed to take a sufficient interest in what's going on in Venezuela. Several years ago, there was in fact some positive coverage of Chavez and the promise of redressing economic inequalities in Venezuela, of better distributing things, of resisting neoliberalism. And those needs remain pressing. But what the Canadian media haven't tracked closely enough is the switch. As President Chavez went from being a colorful populist folkloric leader on El Presidente, present in homes in a way with no equivalent in Canada, but the Canadian media failed to track the deterioration of democracy in all respects, the criminalization of the opposition, the brutal repression of the student protesters. And so tonight I hope to a small degree we've redressed that ignorance and lack of attention within Canada. It's great you're here tonight. Social media is very powerful, but there's still something very special about people coming together in a room with interest, concern, with anger. And I would invite you not to let this end tonight, but to take very seriously the suggestions of Professor Kotler, that there are things that we can do here very concretely, telling our government in Ottawa, for example, that it's not acceptable to leave this issue off the agenda. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here tonight.